So, where and when were you born?
I was born on the 6th of February in Augsburg in Germany.
And is that Aquarius?
That is Aquarius, yeah, that's right.
You know, it's so interesting because a lot of the people that I've interviewed are Aquarians, and it makes sense. It makes
I'm
sense.
not particularly interested in astrology and I don't know much about it, but I've heard about it, yeah.
That they're. I'm interested in any kind of typology, any kind of. Just my brain likes those kind of categories, but it fits because Aquarians are future-oriented, visionary. It's perfect.
That's what people say, yes.
And then you've lived obviously in Germany, Switzerland, England, I don't know where else. Do you
No,
find
those are the stations. Yeah, I've lived in Germany, I was in Switzerland, and then I was in England, and now I'm back in Germany.
and do you find that like when you're working with students that you work differently? Are there different kinds of mindsets when you're in England versus Germany or Switzerland?
Well, I haven't worked with students in Switzerland. I've just lived in Switzerland and worked in Freiburg in Germany because that's just across the border. And I would say maybe there are different mindsets. A little, or let's say there are different approaches to education in England and in the German-speaking countries, because in Germany, education is more broadly conceived. So at least at the time when I was younger and was teaching at university regularly, we used to have a broad outlook over education, whereas in England, the young people are very quickly funneled into subjects they prefer. So, I mean, nowadays you could do A levels in England with no subject matter in languages. You know, you could do, say, sociology, psychology, and arts, and not know anything about math, not know anything about languages, not know anything about your own language, and that wouldn't be possible in Germany. So there is, I think, a little bit of a broad outlook in Germany, even more so in Switzerland and in Austria.
But even in Germany, you go to gymnasium if you're headed towards university, and you go to a technical secondary school if you're not, right?
Yeah, that's right. But in our A level, which we call maturity, you have to have at least one foreign language, and you have to have German, and you have to have some sort of natural science topic. So you can't, you know, you can't bypass the major topics, whereas in England you can.
If you want to graduate from high school.
Yeah.
Right. Got it. Speaking of personality types, do you know your Myers-Briggs or
No, I don't. I'm interested.
you're not interested?
No, I'm not really interested.
But you're a psychologist.
Yeah, but you know, I don't believe much in those typologies. I mean, I've done a lot of work using all sorts of depth psychological methods. Like I did my own psychotherapeutic training, and so I know a lot. But I don't find those typologies very helpful. I mean, they are sort of helpful, and I know myself well enough to know that I'm kind of intuitive and that sort of thing, but I don't know my formal Myers-Briggs type.
I'll send you a link because my hypothesis is that all these leaders in creating the new paradigm are intuitive rather than sensing, and so far that's been true.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly true for me as well. So if you want a intuitive typology of myself from a Jungian point of view, then I'm certainly more intuitive than rational.
Yeah.
That's
So you have two PhDs. What in your childhood, in your upbringing, led you to be an achiever academically?
Actually, you know, that was more an incidental finding of myself. I was actually more like a lazy guy, but I happened to not find the topics in school very demanding. So I was just doing things as they came along and liked it. That was probably how I saw it. I did lots of things next to what I had to do. So I did a lot of music. And I had a lot of social and out of school engagements next to school, and school was more what I did on the side, as it were.
And then why did you decide on psychology as your field?
Why did I decide on psychology? In fact, you know, I thought psychology was an interesting topic because I was always interested in people. And initially I wanted to be more like a healing person or a therapist, and so I found psychology would be a good subject for me.
Mm-hmm. What about the religious context of the family that you grew up in? How did that influence you?
Well, that's difficult to say. My family was kind of normally religious, as you were in Bavaria. You know, Bavaria, where I grew up, is a Catholic country, and no one in my family was overly religious, and there was not a particularly harsh drive towards religion. I was educated at a school that was led by Benedictine monks in Augsburg, and that certainly influenced me by way of broader context. But when I was 15 or so, I actually dropped all formal religious creeds and formal religious belief systems and had a kind of atheist in-between time of maybe a year or so, or two even, until I discovered a meditation group which was next to our school, and through that I had my own experiences, and that brought me back to spirituality and to understanding religious teachings from a more inward kind of thing. So I would say I dropped formal religion at some point and rediscovered it for myself.
So that was when you were just 16 that you found
that was when I was 16, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what kind of form of meditation did they teach?
Well, it was actually taught by a group of progressive nuns, and they did all sorts of things. So we did yoga, we did formal Zen meditation, we did imaginative meditations, we were just listening to music, and I guess it was a mix of various methods, you would call it today. And I settled eventually on a Zen kind of meditation myself. But in between, I also did some meditation along the tradition of the Ignatian exercises for maybe 5 years or so, until I found that was too much of an imaginative type of work for me. And so I settled with a very generic Zen type of meditation from then on.
When I think of Zen meditation, I think of sitting and trying to keep your mind free of thoughts, and except maybe working on a koan, some kind of unsolvable problem to keep your mind from going off in a logical direction. How would you describe Zen meditation?
Yeah, it's probably a very generic concentrative or a collection type of meditation. You're using a syllable to concentrate on.
A mantra.
Yeah, like a mantra. It's called a bato in the Zen tradition, and that's what I do. But my feeling is that is also something that broadens out mindfulness in a very generic sense. So it's not just the meditation. I think it's also important to let the fruits of meditation grow in the garden of ordinary life, let's say.
Oh, I love that. That's a great expression. In other words, to take the centeredness into how you don't react to ordinary stresses and strains. Yeah. My next question is for readers and listeners, and that is, when have been the difficult times in your life, and how did you cope? I think that's a useful question.
Yeah, I had a lot of difficult times in my life, and I think the way to cope with it was for me to just have that kind of inner compass, which I really do derive from my meditation practice, and not get disturbed too much about it. I mean, it does upset you, you know, when people stop your funding, for instance, and you get the impression there is no money coming along your road after the next 2 months. And I had that situation various times. But my experience was by just trusting that I was on the right path, something would come along, and so it was.
Beautiful. I think a lot of people would say that having children is really difficult for the relationship between the parents, and it's difficult having a baby wake you up every night, and it's difficult dealing with teenagers. Was that part of your experience?
No, I don't think that's true. At least it wasn't true for me. I think it's actually making your life richer and more real and more earthbound. Because you just have to deal with ordinary things, you know. Wipe away the shit and make a child that is suffering from pain calm again, and that takes some time. And of course it distracts you from what you might want to do otherwise. But then that also helps you to, at least it was for me, to really appreciate the time that you then have and dedicate it more properly. Because otherwise what often happens is, you know, you have all the time, but you don't do what you should be doing because you have all sorts of things on your mind or you're being distracted. And I find all these things, they are very good funnels. They funnel you into concentrating on what needs to be done.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. That's my experience. How many children do you have?
Well, we have four.
Oh, so you had a busy household.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, until they were all gone.
Yeah, right.
But that's fine as well. I mean, I liked it.
Doing meditation and focusing on spiritual aspects of life, do you find that you get those aha experiences, downloading of information? I think you referred to it as popping up out of the contemplative practice. Has it been useful for you in your work?
Yeah, sure. I would say this is the generic source of inspiration that comes along all the time, mostly when I'm not thinking of it, because meditation practice is more like training your mind when you don't really need it, so that when you need it, you have it ready. And so those inspirations, they come along as you need them, and I take them as they come. So sometimes they come at very unexpected times, you know, in the morning, in the evening, sometimes during dreams. And then I just take them and wait until the impulse either goes away, or if it doesn't go away, I take it seriously and then I follow it.
What's an example of an insight in terms of your research or your writing where it you came up with something that you were surprised about or didn't expect?
Well, maybe the most generic thing which I'm still working at is this idea to generalize the entanglement relationship that we know from quantum mechanics to systems and situations outside of physics. That was something which popped up in my mind quite early. I was doing a lot of reading at the time, and I had these paradoxical data sitting in front of me, and I was trying to make sense of them. And it suddenly occurred to me that this is really very similar to what I was reading and what I knew from the physical situation. And then it popped up in my mind that actually we might have a very similar relationship in other systems. And that just came out of the blue. And it sat around a while, and I thought about it, and I thought about the ramifications and spoke with people about it, until it kind of materialized more in a formal sense when I then had. And then what normally happens is that if such an idea is really fruitful, then I see a lot of synchronicities happen. So I meet people that help me onwards, or I have discussions with friends that point me towards certain directions, or even discussions with people who are not friendly, but it doesn't really matter. And in that case, so I had this idea, and then I, by coincidence, met Hartmann Römer, who was the chair of physics in Freiburg, and by coincidence, he was present when I gave a talk on these issues, and he said, well, actually, it's a good idea, why don't we follow that on? And I then wrote a paper together with him, which prompted him to write the formalism of generalized quantum theory, and that again brought it with me that Harald Atzmansbacher joined in, and so a paper came out of that, and so things kind of fell together, you know, as it were. And that is what I usually experience when ideas that pop up have some value. Then normally they meet up with occurrences in the outside world that make them, let's say, grounded and realizable. And if that doesn't happen, then I give them up, or I let them sit on the shelf until I find an opportunity to make them real.
Right. It's very tempting to say with quantum entanglement that the entangled particles, if they're separated and the spin on one photon is changed, the other changes instantaneously, so we conclude there's some kind of medium of communication, of information field that would explain why we can do telepathy and ESP and prayer from a distance. But physicists will say, no, we don't know what causes that kind of communication, and don't use the word communication. So what have physicists said to you in terms of the mechanism for that exchange?
Well, I think physicists are correct to be really careful there, because, and also we are not calling this a physical entanglement, because physical entanglement, as in quantum systems, is a very specific kind of state a system is in, which needs a high level of preparation, isolation, and is really a very, very artificial system that is very difficult to prepare. So when I'm using the word entanglement, I'm talking about a generalized form, which may even be only, say, a metaphor for what we are experiencing using the knowledge of physics about those entangled states to trying to understand what is going on there. So I think even the term of mechanism is wrong, because mechanism is a word that comes from a, let's call it Newtonian physicalist framework, where you see a mechanism that causes something, like my switching on the light causes the light going on and making the room brighter. I don't even think that this is what is happening there. It's more like a correlated occurrence of things that seem to be meaningfully related and somehow sensibly connected, but we don't know how. So the Jungian term of synchronicity is probably one that might help here, because Jung was thinking of correlations between mental and physical occurrences without any further causal connections between them. And I think that is what is actually happening. But we do not have a good theoretical model for that. Our model of generalized entanglement is just one way of looking at things, and it's more like a metaphorical way of putting things. And it's certainly not meant to use the physical entanglement between elementary particles as an explanation, but more as an image for what is happening there.
So I don't know how you can get around using the word mechanism. What allows...
I think just using it. Very simple.
Okay. What process allows ESP, telepathy, clairvoyance, healing at a distance, all those kind of things where minds connect through space without any kind of obvious way of connecting them?
Well, we don't know. the model which I have just tried to sketch would be a generalized way of entanglement, which would mean a correlation between systems that is built up through the setup, how systems are set up, and a decisive element is probably consciousness. So how we partition the world, what we engage with, makes up a system. And sometimes we also use ritualistic demarcations of those systems. So for instance, if you form a prayer ritual, you do something to connect with a certain person. Either you imagine this person, or you have something in front of you, or you mention their names or whatnot. And that is a kind of ritualistic preparation of a unitary system between yourself, your consciousness, and the person you're praying for. And so I think what is happening there is, that's one way of looking at things, is that our consciousness is getting in engaged there and may be able to produce a state of mind and a state of presence that somehow, just by the way of how the system is set up, translates into something correlated in the other person's field of consciousness.
So that it requires intention?
It requires intention, and it requires a certain presence of mind, certainly. Yeah. I don't think that this is happening incidentally or just by accident. It may, but I don't know. But there are other ways of conceptualizing this. And the way I'm conceptualizing it is probably, I would say, a more parsimonious one, because I don't want to postulate any particular fields or any particular particles or any particular energies or anything like that. I'm just saying maybe the way how we partition the world and maybe how we set up systems enables us to become part of that system, and by that becoming part of it, either extract or experience information that is part of that larger system, or be influential within that system by the way how we form or how we pitch our consciousness. And other people might say, well, in order to really scientifically understand that, you need to build up a hyperspatial model with, I don't know, X dimensions in addition to the four we are living in. That might also be true. But I'm not a physicist, so I can't really speak to that. I'm just saying the model I'm preferring or I'm describing here is a more parsimonious one, I think. But I'm not saying it's the correct one.
Well, then we need to define consciousness, because if that's like the core of everything, how do you define consciousness?
That's a very good question. I don't know how to answer that. I mean, consciousness is really a complex issue. And one way of looking at consciousness is certainly its relational aspect. So we always are in relation to something, for instance, to some part of ourselves, in being conscious of ourselves. In being conscious of what we perceive of, in being conscious of what we intend to do. And sometimes consciousness can also be contentless, just being pure presence. So it would be its own object, as it were. Mm. Then, because Brentano defined consciousness as something, some stance that is related to something else. And that is usually the case, but you can also have pure consciousness, for instance, in a meditative state where you are not related to anything else, but just to reality as such, as it were. Mm-hmm. Self as consciousness. A non-dual state, as it were.
Right. That's so interesting. You got into trouble for working with a master student with using the Kozriev mirror to talk about how telepathy works. What was all that about?
Well, that's a complicated story. But I don't think I got, I did not work with the Kosy Rif Mir at all. It was more like one of our students, I used to run a study course for medical doctors. So this was a postgraduate master's degree course for medical doctors, training them in cultural sciences and complementary medicine. That was what the course was about. And I was running a methods class there on research methods. And one of those guys was interested in the ideas of Kosy Rif. And Kosy Rif is a Russian physicist who had developed an alternative kind of world model in which time is a variable that you can manipulate. For instance, in quantum physics, time doesn't even enter the equations. The equations of quantum physics are time invariant. And in relativity theory, time is one of the four dimensions, and it is fixed by this the limit of light. Now, Kosy Rif developed an alternative way of looking at the world, and in his model, time is a variable that you can manipulate. So those people who are interested in Kosy Rif's theory, they use what is called a Kosy Rif mirror in order to manipulate time. I don't know the details of that theory at all. It was just something our student was interested in. And so we were discussing how could you test that theory. And so he was actually, we were developing a little experiment. And so the experiment was about creating a miniature Kosy Rif mirror, which was about this big, so in a certain proportion to the real one, which it should have, proportion it should have. It was fitted into a little box and connected with cables. And his hypothesis was that people who would be connected to that mirror would be better able to telepathically guess what content was in there. So he put paper slips in there with numbers from 0 to 9, and they were in hidden envelopes, and it was in that box, and the box was closed, and the box was connected to those cables. And then he made a telepathy experiment, and the experiment was actually quite good. It was triple blind, so nobody knew about the mirror, about the figures. He didn't know them, people didn't know them. They were in the envelope, and he ran about 600 experiments or so. So it was actually quite a good experiment. And in the end, it turned out that there was only one way, one situation where people were guessing better, and that was when they could actually see that the cables were attached to the cylinder without knowing what numbers were in the envelope. So it was still blinded, but they saw that they were attached. And so in that situation, the probability of guessing the right figures was more than you would expect by chance. It was an incidental finding. And the problem was that the write-up of the paper, which he, it was actually a thesis, a master thesis, an unpublished master thesis. The write-up was very bad. It was not in scientific language. And he used a lot of tertiary references because all the primary material was in Russian and he couldn't read Russian. So he had to rely on translations and on secondary or tertiary material. So the write-up was not good enough. And our course, complementary medicine course, had a lot of critics in the skeptical arena. So the skeptical community was very critical about that because we were the only public university in Germany so far offering a course like that, and that created a lot of stir. And the government of the country in Brandenburg was not interested either. And so there was a campaign ongoing, and they used that bad write-up of the paper to say that what we were doing was not scientific. That is the gist of the story. But it is not that I did anything with that. It was more our student not writing properly.
I'm thinking that the cables acted like placebo. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, we don't know, because that wasn't the primary hypothesis in the first place. So it could be, yeah. And we published that paper subsequently in the scientific literature, and it's available for anybody to look at who can read German in that case, because it's in German language. But it's published.
And that was at Freiburg, the university.
No, that was in Frankfurt on the Oder, at the Viadrina University, the last place I was at in Germany.
And are there other universities now that are offering complementary medicine to health workers?
No, there is no, currently there is no course, not a full-fledged one. I mean, there are many courses around that educate doctors and that train doctors in complementary medicine. They are mostly offered by doctors' associations, specialized groups of doctors, and there are many possibilities for doctors who want to train, say, in acupuncture, in homeopathy, or in phytotherapy, to take additional qualification courses anywhere in Germany or in Austria and Switzerland, but none of them is offered by a university as far as I can see.
And then you started a master's program at Nottingham University in England, right?
That was a different one, not in Nottingham, that was in Northampton.
Northampton,
and our master's program there was a consecutive master's program for consciousness studies and transpersonal psychology. That's what I started when I went there in 2005, yes.
It seems like there's a lot of interest in psi research in England, that Edinburgh, and then it's spread from there around the universities throughout the country.
I wouldn't call that a lot of interest. There is some interest, and there has also been some interest in all sorts of places. But compared with other times, I don't think it has grown much. I mean, in England, you have Edinburgh University, where you have people, and you have various individual scholars around the country who are interested. In Northampton, there is a small group of people who is interested, but that is about it in the UK.
Are there other places that you know of, universities and research centers that are working on this kind of psi research or transpersonal?
No, there are not many. I mean, most of the time it's individual researchers that are sometimes connected to universities, sometimes there are private researchers. There are a couple in Holland, there are a couple in France, there is us in Germany, and then there are a few people in Austria. I think there are also some in Hungary, but I don't have any contact with them. And so if you go to a PA or a Society for Scientific Exploration conference, it's quite amazing. You always find individuals that do some type of research, but there are no larger entities like research groups or institutes, apart from those we've mentioned, where you have that type of research.
In the U.S., I think of the University of Virginia's
program. You have the people at the University of Virginia. You have IONS in on the West Coast. I believe that's where you are, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Gary Schwartz at University of Arizona.
Yeah, Gary at the University of Arizona has a larger center, but that is then roughly it, I would say. You know, and then there is Ezio Cardenia in Lund with his chair of hypnotherapy and hypnosis and parapsychology. But I think that's probably... And then there are people like Julia Mossbridge and Patrizia Tresoldi in Italy. But these are more individuals, you know. There is no, I don't perceive any coherent research institute currently at the university. Most of them are outside of universities.
Interesting. Why do you think that the skeptics are so eager to pounce on anything that they think isn't scientific, it's pseudo-scientific? I mean, even Wikipedia goes through and changes. It's totally irrational.
Well, it is irrational in the sense of generic rationality, but it's very rational in their sense of rationality. So I think what is happening there is we are seeing a kind of religious war, I would call it. Yeah, because there is a scientific mainstream that assumes that science has actually shown that materialism is the correct way of looking at the world. Let's put it this way. Now, I would call this another belief system. Materialism is actually a belief system. It's nothing to do with science. It just so happens that some scientists have looked at the world in this way. And the skeptic community is particularly zealous and convinced group of people who believe that materialism is the correct way of looking at the world. So they are, in a sense, in the same way, ideologically biased as Islamic terrorists are ideologically biased. I'm using a very strong image here to make the point clear, because both groups think it's completely clear that what they say is true, and anybody else who is of a different opinion should be not only proven incorrect, they should also be wiped off the earth, in a sense. And so the skeptics community is very vocal in trying to fight these type of things, because they think it is threatening a consensus of rationality, which is actually not even existent. It's just their way of looking at things. And because it is not about facts, but about paradigm, the resistance and the fights are so cruel.
Cruel's a good, that's a good word. That's an accurate word.
Because, you know, whenever it's just a matter that you can settle by empirical means, it's actually quite easy. You discuss whether you do this experiment or that experiment, then you do it and you know the outcome. But the point is, a scientific fact is not just an empirical evidence. It's always empirical evidence together with an appropriate theory that is accepted. And the appropriate theory that is accepted is always sitting on the background of a world model that is also accepted. And the world model that the skeptics community is buying into is a materialistic world model. And they think it is actually proven that this is true, but that is exactly the point where I think they are wrong, and where ideology comes into play. This has nothing to do with science, it's just ideology.
Mm-hmm. You were involved in the Galileo report.
I actually wrote it.
You wrote it. And I had a criticism for you, because in there you say that you say that there's not much evidence for psi phenomena, but if in fact, like Dean Radin's book show, there's many.
In fact, I did not say that. If you say that, you haven't read my report properly. I did not say there is no evidence. I said there is a lot of evidence, but I said there is no consistent evidence that leads us to the conclusion that whatever is there is a causal phenomenon in the sense of physically causal. That is my conclusion. And this has to do with the fact that we have a lot of meta-analyses that actually show that there are strong effects in the sense of significantly strong effects. The effects themselves are usually small, but they are significantly strong. But when it comes to identical replications that would be able to really establish causality, then I think the skeptics are actually right to say that there is no single experiment that you can take out of the whole system, give it to whoever is a skilled experimenter, and repeat that experiment X amount of times and always have the same result. I think we do not have that type of evidence, and in my view, this is part and parcel of the signature of the effects we are talking about, because they are not causal in nature. That is what I said. And that is different from saying there is not enough evidence. I think there is lots of evidence to say that these effects are veridical and they are factual, but they are of a different nature than getting up and switching on the light, because getting up and switching on the light works all the time. But sitting down and praying for the health of somebody else does not work in the same way. That's the difference.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the studies that where people are shown slides and they react precognitively to the disturbing slides. Yeah. I mean, that's an example that's been replicated in different labs and different...
Yeah, but there are also examples where these replications failed. And the important thing is to see if you have a meta-analysis, you put all the data in and out comes the average effect and its significance. And I would say the average effect and its significance is established. But what is not established is that this paradigm works every time you use it with everybody. And why that is not the case, we do not know. But I think it should be acknowledged also as a by way of fairness and by way of truthfulness, that this is also part and parcel of the data that we have from parapsychology research, that it's not a simple switching on thing. And there is a lot of debate in the community about that. Some people would say, no, we have shown it. Some people say, no, we haven't shown that. And I happen to belong to the group that is skeptical about the replicability of these issues, not about the generic factuality. I think that has been established. But the replicability of single paradigms is not established, I would say.
Right. And I think
Even Dean has not established that. Because if you look carefully, I love Dean's work because he's a really gifted experimenter and he has produced beautiful studies. And he's produced lots of positive studies. But if you look carefully, he always changes something. And if you talk to him, and you probably have, and ask him, then he will say he never does the same study twice because that tends to diminish the effects and that tends to bore him and that tends to not work properly. And this is, in fact, the case.
I think you're absolutely right. It's not like turning on a light switch. It's not mechanistic because we're dealing with a phenomena that isn't Newtonian, as you said.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So you talk about how to do different kinds of research, that you research whole systems observationally, qualitatively, comparative effectiveness. Could you comment, because you've taught this, how do we accurately research psi phenomena?
Well, I'm not sure there is one true way of doing that. I'm always... fond of multiple approaches. So it's a little bit like agriculture. You know, monoculture is always a bad idea. If you have hectares and hectares of cornfields, that's boring. If you have loads of experimental studies, that's also boring. So I think what we need is we need experimental studies to see how does this effect show in controlled environments. We need really good field studies to see what is happening in the field, and I think we have not enough of that. We need good qualitative research to see how does that impact people's lives and how does having these experiences make a difference to people or doesn't it make differences, that sort of thing. So we need a multiplicity of approaches, and probably... there is also a kind of hidden dialectics or complementarity there. The more you can control things, the less important they are for people. And the more important these effects are for people, the less you can control them. So the really huge effects like poltergeist and spook effects that are really impactful for people, or say... transforming near-death experiences. You can't control in the lab. They just happen to people. And you can study them post-hoc by talking to them, by asking them questions, by interviewing them, and then you may see huge effects, but then they are out of your control. And the more you can control them, the smaller the effects become. And that seems to be the way how the world is made up.
Right.
So figuratively speaking, you cannot use an experiment to force people into believing. That's not possible, I think. I think if you are open to those dimensions, then the whole panoply of data which we have will suggest to you that there is something there. But if you are not open, there is no way how experiments or data can force you into believing there is something there.
It's interesting that when people get bored with doing a repetitive task, like predicting what card is going to appear, then the effect goes down. So if we're interested, like remote viewers didn't have that boredom effect, so they kept on being accurate in their remote viewing. So our emotions definitely play a part in all this.
Yeah, and also the way how the real world is actually brought into that experiment or into the task. You know, if you are pressing buttons, that has nothing to do with the real world. It's just an experimental abstraction, and therefore the effects that you are looking at are bound to be small.
It's interesting. What's the Scientific and Medical Network? They're the group that sponsored the report that you wrote, the Galileo report.
Yeah, the Scientific and Medical Network is a group that has formed, I think, in the 70s, out of mostly medical people, but also other scientists in the UK who were uneasy about the mainstream materialistic paradigm and wanted to open up the discussion and create a little, let's say, a little sanctuary for those who dissent and have other opinions, to allow them to voice these opinions, to discuss that with peers and like-minded people, and bring in evidence and people that would speak to whatever their experiences are. And out of that has grown a network of people who are a little bit more open-minded, I would say, than the normal mainstream scientific community is.
And it seems like the thrust is acknowledging that we're creating a new paradigm that's non-materialistic.
Yes, I think that's the idea. Mm-hmm.
And that's happening not just in England, but everywhere, as you say, where people are researching.
It looks as if many people are coming from various directions and finding very similar results and very similar types of analysis, yes.
If you look at this historically, and you are educated as a historian of science, when do you think the wave started to crest in terms of, oh, we are creating a new paradigm that acknowledges the limits of materialism?
Well, in fact, I think that the first instance of that is actually the development of quantum mechanics beginning of the 20th century. That was when it started, and it's been moving along the waters, as it were, and is now reaching biology, medicine, psychology. It has probably already reached psychology to some degree, but it's not gone through all the science. I think in all branches of science and in all fields, you have people who think a little bit more open and who have various experiences that would challenge a materialistic mainstream paradigm, but it has not voiced itself into a coherent picture, as it were. So it's more like a wave that ripples through various branches ever since the revolution of quantum theory in the beginning of the 20th century.
What about systems theory and chaos theory and mathematics? Is that pertinent?
Yeah, I think that belongs to part of it. Although you can be a system theoretical thinker and be perfectly happy with a materialistic worldview. I think there is nothing in system theory that challenges a reductionist ontology. It challenges maybe a too crude reductionist ontology, but it still allows you to, for instance, think that consciousness is just a complex emergent property of a complex system like the brain. So that is still possible. So I don't think system theory is inherently necessarily part of a new paradigmatic approach to science, although it certainly opens up the vista and the way of thinking.
Interesting. You write about a methodology where we value the first person inner experience, and you talk about Francis Bacon, who died in 1626, advocated that method of scientific understanding.
That's in fact a misunderstanding. I was talking about Roger Bacon, who died in 1297.
Mm-hmm.
1292.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different
person. And do you think that this valuing inner experience is in fact being more valued?
Yeah, I think so. I think in consciousness studies you see that. There are various moves in psychology and in consciousness studies where we have a return to a first-person methodology. It's not a big strand, but it's growing because people are discovering that you cannot just look at MRI pictures if you want to understand what people are experiencing. You can look at MRI pictures, but you also want to see the inner phenomenology of what those pictures are about. Mm-hmm. And that you can only discover when you talk to people and ask them about their experiences. So I think there is a strand of people in the neuroscience community that are advocating that phenomenological inner stance that was actually propagated by Varela and others in the late 80s already, and that has grown ever since. Then there is a group of people in psychology coming from various areas that have started to understand that there is not just third-person views from the outside that are valid, but also first-person views from the inside. That has already made its way as qualitative methodology in psychology and in social science, but is now even grounded more deeply into first-person methodology of, say, contemplative neuroscience, where you have people who have experiences with contemplation, experiencing the way their mind works and reporting those experiences. So, yes, I think there are inroads now, and they are getting ever more present.
I wrote a book called Ageism and Youth Studies because I've been researching global youth, and I was astonished to find that in books about youth, they did not talk to youth. They would not quote a single young person. They maybe rely on multiple choice surveys done on the internet, but they didn't talk to young people. So I think that's another example of scientists get so locked up into the numbers, they forget that, oh, hey, let's talk to this person. Can you turn on the light in your room?
I can, yeah. Just hang on a minute. I have to get up.
Okay.
Do I have to sit on a different chair, or is this okay for you?
If you get closer, then you can block the light, so that's good.
This?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Then you need to move to your right, because the light's like, yeah.
Like this?
Yes. Thank
okay.
you. You developed a questionnaire to measure exceptional human experiences. How did that work?
Well, it was one of those ideas I once had, and then we cooked up a series of items, and I got a student who was then my master's student and later became my PhD student, postdoc, and friend and colleague, and he took that up and made a series of studies using that questionnaire, and then we validated it and used it for various studies.
What's an example of a question on that questionnaire?
Well, for instance, the specificity of that questionnaire is that we wanted to look at exceptional experiences that are spiritual on the one side, but also exceptional experiences that you would call maybe destabilizing psychiatric experiences. So we have items like I have the experience of positive forces helping me, or sometimes, or I've had the experiences, the experience of a light helping me, and then my world for you breaks down, or I've had the experience that all I believed crashed, or sometimes I hear voices that make fun of me and chide me, that type of thing. So it's a mix of spiritual, positive, negative spiritual experiences and psychopathological experiences. And in that questionnaire, we can actually show that there are four dimensions: positive spiritual experiences, negative spiritual experiences, or deconstructive experiences, as we also call them, visionary states, a smaller factor, and psychiatric symptoms. So you can separate those out, because that was part of our question also, because traditional psychiatrists often lump spiritual experiences together with hallucinations. And I think that's a mistake, because they are different. And we can show, using that questionnaire, that they are not only phenomenologically different, but also psychometrically different.
And is that questionnaire available in English?
It is. Yeah. We translated it in English, and most of the studies we actually did in English.
What is the name of the questionnaire?
It's called Exceptional Human Experiences Questionnaire.
Okay,
got it. I can send it to you if you remind me by email. I'll send it to you in a couple of studies.
Thank you. You talk about a circular model for medical research. What's that?
Well, that was actually a direct challenge of the prevailing hierarchical model. The hierarchical model of evidence-based medicine is the most prevalent one. And it stipulates that there is a hierarchy of methods, meaning that there are methods that are better and worse. So the better methods are randomized controlled trials, and if you combine the results of randomized controlled trials and meta-analysis, you have the true effect size. That's the idea. And everything below that, natural cohort studies or single case observational studies or case series, they are of less dignity, in the sense of they are less reliable and they have no use. So the logic of that is, once you have data from randomized controlled studies, you can throw away the rest. That's why most meta-analyses and systematic reviews only look at randomized controlled trials. And the argument we've been building up is that this is actually wrong, because there is no such thing as the best method. There is only adequate method for proper questions. So if you have the question, is a new intervention better than placebo, then clearly a randomized controlled, placebo-controlled study is the method of choice. But if you want to know whether a new method that has been proven effective in a small group of people is also effective in a large population, then the method of choice is a big cohort study, where you roll out that method to a large population and see whether it's accepted, whether there are lots of side effects or not, whether it works the same as in that small group you tested is in the first place. So the circular model would argue that you need different types of evidence put together to find the true usefulness of any intervention. And part and parcel of that is randomized studies, but you also have other studies like observational studies that come into play. And there is no use of outplaying the rigor of randomized studies against the ecological validity of other studies, because internal and external validity, technically speaking, are incompatible concepts. You cannot maximize both in one type of study. You can either maximize internal validity, and by necessity, you neglect external validity then. Or you maximize external validity, and then you have to neglect internal validity. And the consequence of that situation is that you need different types of studies in order to get the full picture.
That's common sense, but that doesn't mean that it's believed in.
It's common sense, that's true, but not often. Common sense is also what is scientifically accepted.
Right, I really found that. You were initially interested in homeopathy and its efficacy. And it's interesting to me because maybe not even an atom of the original calcium or phosphorus or whatever it was is in the homeopathy little sugar pill. So yeah. What did you find about the reason it works?
Well, I'm not sure I have a good theory there. All I see is it's very similar. Actually, the database of homeopathy is very similar to the database of parapsychology. And that led me to the conclusion that what we have in homeopathy is probably actually similar to what we have in parapsychology. That's why I developed the generalized entanglement model in the first place. Because I think we also have correlational effects here that are truly specific. So it doesn't make a difference whether you choose the right remedy or not. But what you have there is not a stable cause like a light switch that you can switch on, but some correlational effect, which we don't understand yet, I would say. So there is no information or no, I think there is no information, no causal effect in those remedies, but they do work nevertheless quite specifically. So it's a kind of, I don't know what. Sometimes I call it modern magic, but it's a word that is also not very well received because it has the wrong connotations. So I don't know what it is.
Well, some people suggest that it's vibrational, that the you know the percussing and the original substance change the vibration. And we know that water can be changed by, like at Lourdes, the water's different.
These are all nice metaphors, I would say, but we don't know what it is. I think we know from the empirical signature of the effects that it's very similar to what we see in parapsychology. I don't think there is any causal mechanism buried in those remedies. And nevertheless, they are necessary in the way they are produced for the effect. So probably need someone else to figure out what is going on there.
What about acupuncture? That's more specific in terms of working with energy channels that can be measured and viewed.
I think we are further down the road there, yes. It looks as if acupuncture can be conceptualized using the interstitial tissue. So there is some research by Langevin. That's her name, I think. She is somewhere in Connecticut or someplace. They showed that the connective tissue is very important for acupuncture effects. So there might be something like additional tissues and additional lines of information, let's put it, in the connective tissue. For instance, in the network of osteoblasts that we have in the connective tissue, which forms a true network of information, which is often neglected. And so it could be the case that this network of information within the connective tissue forms the basis of acupuncture effects, I would say. Because there you have a true physical intervention, so the needle goes into the skin, it's being pulled around, and that pulling around has effects on the connective tissue. And then distant effects are happening that can be understood and explained by using the network of cells within the connective tissue and the effects they have on distant electric properties, such as through piezoelectric effects and similar.
You know, people are very interested in energy psychology, acupressure tapping, emotional freedom technique, all those acronyms. Are you hearing people use those kind of techniques? And any ideas about why they work? Because there's no needle.
I don't know. I mean, we have made a study with a PhD student of ours who used what is called quantum healing, which is an advanced technique of all those energy freedom techniques, and that works without any tapping at all. It's just touching a part of the body and intensely imagining a future state of health, and it has huge effects. So we just published a study on that. The effects are really dramatic. And I think what is actually happening there is, again, consciousness intervening. And all these rituals are probably important for directing the concentrative aspects of consciousness, I think.
It sets your intention if you're visualizing.
It sets your intention. It keeps you busy, you know. It keeps you active. And maybe if you can do that without any ritual, that's fine as well. And some people can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where meditation comes in. You developed the Freeberg Mindfulness Inventory about mindfulness research. That has to do with meditation?
Yeah.
And what are you measuring?
Well, it was developed by a student of mine who I supervised, and it's just a set of items that is measuring what we think is a mindful state of mind. And it's like measuring a construct, like measuring depression. Only we are not measuring depression, we are measuring mindfulness. And to some extent, you can always do that with a self-report questionnaire. The question is, how useful is that? I think it is useful to some degree. You can do that for research purposes, for instance, or if you want to check on a group of people's progress through a meditation program, then you can use that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is that meditation changes the brain. It develops part of the brain in a physiological, measurable
way. That seems
way.
To be the case, yes.
Yeah.
That's true.
Let's see. So you edit a book series, Neuroscience, Consciousness, and Spirituality. Where is that headed?
Well, this is a book series we published with Springer, and the idea is to allow people and ideas that are working at the interface between neuroscience, consciousness studies, spirituality to publish their results. And we've published a couple of books in that series now, and there are a couple of other books in the review process currently. And it's an opportunity to publish work that would have difficulties in the classical channels, I would say.
Mm. The trouble with Springer is that their books are really, really expensive, right?
Yeah, that is true, and that's nothing we can do because that's just the policy of the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not know that before we started that series with that publisher. We were a little bit naive at that point, let's put it this way.
Mm. So what's the next book, the title of the next book that's going to come out from Springer?
I don't know yet, because there are a couple of books in the review process. I don't know yet.
Okay. And are you have another book that you're writing in your mind?
Yeah, there are two. I mean, the one which you already know is that Galileo Report, the longer version, which you probably have, which I want to bring out as a book if possible. And that would be Science Beyond a Materialist Worldview. And then there is probably a more extensive one, which has the working title The Inescapability of Religion for Scientists, even.
Because then materialism is a kind of religion.
Yes.
Got it. I'm wondering, if you look at the world situation and climate change and climate weirdness and maybe only having 12 years to turn it around, and the rise of autocrats and the growth of inequality around the world, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I'm always optimistic, but I do see the grave challenges we are facing. And I think we will only be able to turn the wheel around if we are actually working together and if people are willing to make the necessary choices in their individual lives, like, you know, living sustainably and that sort of thing.
Germany is really a leader in encouraging solar panels and wind, and you can,
true,
they
yes.
make it so that individuals can get involved, right?
But we could do better, I think.
Of course.
Yeah.
As a person who's written over 150 peer-reviewed journal articles and book chapters and books, what do you do for fun and renewing yourself?
Well, I meditate, I sing, I meet with people, and have a lot of fun, if possible. And I like reading. Reading novels, historic novels, occasionally watching films, good films, going to concerts. I live in Berlin. There is a lot of stuff going on there, so I can go to operas, to concerts. I went to a concert yesterday evening, for instance.
Do you feel like singing anything for us?
No.
Is there anything that should be included in your chapter that we haven't discussed?
Well, probably, I think what is important is that we install a global culture of consciousness in the sense of mental hygiene. You know, everybody making it part of their routine to take half an hour out to clean their spirit and their mind. The image which I always use is the best or the most important invention that saved the most lives was hygiene in medicine, physical hygiene. And it's very natural to us. So we go to the bathroom, we wash our hands, we shower in the morning, we have separation of loo and drinking water, that sort of thing. And that saved a lot of lives and is still saving lives in poor countries where it's being introduced. And in the same sense, I think we need to introduce mental hygiene as a very natural thing. Everybody spends about half an hour at least in the bathroom every day. And I think we need to spend as much time on clearing our mind each day in order to get rid of whatever is preventing us from rightful and useful choices in our lives. I think that is the most decisive thing.
Mm-hmm. You've been interested in teaching these kind of techniques to children.
Yeah.
What was your accomplishment there?
Well, we tried to install a program in schools, and that was quite successful, but we were not able to follow that on for various reasons. Lack of funding was one, but also it's difficult in the German school system because it's very much a top-down system, and you need to have access to the top decision makers in the ministries, and we were not able to access these. So, but it does work, and we published a meta-analysis of the then extant research, and it shows that mindfulness interventions with children do work and improve cognitive capabilities. So I would hope that more research is going down that line, and people are starting to be creative how to introduce that in schools, because it seems to be useful for children. I'm teaching mindfulness to the medical students at Poznan Medical University, where I'm teaching, and they are quite grateful for that.
And what technique do you teach them? Or just a variety?
I teach them various techniques: body scan, breathing meditation, compassion meditation, imagination techniques, and I teach them to choose whatever is most helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
I think there is. The people are in different stages, in different stages of their life. They need different methods. And there is no such thing as the right method. Mm. There is a good method for a person in a certain situation in their life.
Mm. It's interesting that mindfulness has replaced the word meditation because some Christian fundamentals don't like meditation.
Yeah, maybe.
It works.
Doesn't matter what we call it, as long as we do it.
Right.